Good morning. April 5th, 4:05:13. It's, what is it? 8:48 a.m. A little bit later today than I've been all week. I got tied up in postings on Google Plus, among other things. 16 minutes, 7 seconds. Wow, it was a good mile. Anyway, I knew it was because I was cranked. Anyway, there's a lot of stuff swirling about out on the interwebs. There was a post a few days ago about I Am a Self-Publishing Failure by a guy named John Winter that was really one of the best examples of how to do everything wrong possible. And he did it wrong, every single one. And yet, what he did was follow the common wisdom. And he did everything wrong and sold almost no books. He could only give away a few hundred books. Now, this, the depths to which this poor individual sank was unfortunate, and ultimately he, after the Salon article hit, he actually republished his book and put a Kindle book up at $9.99, which is like completely missing the point. Totally stupid. But yesterday, I think it was yesterday, maybe even the day before, Hugh Howey put a rebuttal, also in Salon, about how self-publishing is the future, indie publishing is the future. I forget what the title was now, but it was actually a fairly well-reasoned, except that it depended on anecdotal data to make his point, which is unfortunate because it pretty much got at his entire argument because he based it on what is arguably a false premise. So while his conclusion was arguably correct, the way he got to it was arguably false, which logically is possible, but unfortunate. So John Ward, the ever prolific ponderer of things publishing, and perhaps publical, I'm not sure. Anyway, he put a post up, talked about that, in light of Nightshade Books, a pending deal with Skyhorse, some other small pub is negotiating to buy Nightshade Books assets, namely the contracts. In return for enough money to dig Nightshade Books out of the red so that they can close the doors without declaring bankruptcy. So basically merging Nightshade Books with Skyhorse without the overhead of Nightshade Books. Now, I'm really sorry to see Nightshade Books go because they were one of the larger of the small presses. They did some good work. I did some blurbing and reviewing for Nightshade Books. So I'm sorry to see them go, but this deal with Skyhorse is just dreadful because Skyhorse wants to rewrite all the contracts. And the problem is the Nightshade is holding a stick, and that's the deal is can't go through unless a certain percentage of authors agree to this deal, complete with write-downs and other unspecified contract language, which should be enough to send any self-respecting author running, Stackpole had a big takedown of the whole thing over on Stormwolf. I saw that yesterday as well. So anyway, I left a long post. And I forgot the One Piece. Wendig had a takedown of all of both of the pieces from Salon. He did a rebuttal on his own blog, Terrible Minds, about the I'm a self-publishing failure. And then he provided equal time for Howie. And I think rightly so, he attacked Howie's argument without actually attacking his conclusion, other than to say that declaring something is the future for everyone may be disingenuous. And I think that's probably true. Howard makes a good point. It's that more people than ever are now earning money from writing. And I think, arguably, it becomes self-evident if you start considering how many more books there are now than there were 3 years ago. The number of self-published authors has bloomed, much like red tide blooms, choking out all oxygen and suffocating the fish. But I think arguably, or inarguably, I don't believe anybody would argue. I'll get to a point here eventually, as soon as I get done splitting my own hairs, that more people are earning money from writing. The fact is, some of those people are earning a lot of money writing is not really the point. And that was not the point that Howie was making. Although he spoke from a position of privilege as one of the people who's making a lot of money, which kind of negates a bit of the power of his message. I would have been more impressed if the Salon piece was written by somebody like Brand Gamblin, who is making some money, but not a great deal. He should be making more. Those books are brilliant, but be that as it may, I'm also biased. I think he's a great writer. He's a good guy, and he's a friend of mine, so I have a bias. It would have meant more coming from somebody like Nobilis Reed, who has had some modicum of success in erotica. So Howie was suspect because of his position, because of his privilege of being able to turn down big money offers like I have. I don't write pieces on Salon about it. But there's some interesting points there. So anyway, yeah. I spent a long time actually arguing that neither of the two guys is particularly cogent, or all three of them aren't particularly cogent, because it's really opinion. And arguing opinion as if it were fact is one of the problems that's really endemic. It's hard to find real facts. Real facts are not something you pluck out of the air. It's not like a rock you pick up off the ground. This is a rock. Well, maybe it is. Maybe it's not. Maybe it's a piece of concrete that's been chipped off. But those are kinds of things that you can verify. You can identify the object as a rock based on certain sets of criteria. You can identify plants based on taxonomy. You can establish facts based on logic and reasoning, but you have to start with a valid premise. So, yeah, other than that, what we're talking about is opinion, and these things are essays. They're not articles. In a real sense, most of what we read today is not an article, it's an essay. Almost everything that I write on a blog is an essay. I have written articles, and perhaps because I have written articles, I understand the difference between an article and an essay. An essay is opinion, Monkpole. Essay is an explication of a thought process that governs, perhaps, a value. Fiction, in a lot of ways, is an essay. But because the novel form is its own unique form, because the short story form is its own unique form, it's couched in storytelling terms that nevertheless still use some of the elements of rhetoric that govern the use of the essay form. So I had words about it today. It took some time to think about it. I'm my friend Laura Gibbs, who is a Latin teacher, who's recently moved to North Carolina. She's a fascinating woman. She's had some projects where she's published 365 days of Latin proverbs and tweeted them. It's been a fascinating project to watch how she's used social media to foster Latin scholarship. I mean, you can't think of anything more esoteric, unless it's classical Greek, but still, it's interesting to me to watch her work. Speaking of work, yesterday was a work day. I did get some work done. I solved another plot problem with a gangster, and word processor's waiting for me when I get home, and so is a fresh pot of coffee, and I'm quite excited about getting back to the story. I got the story underway. I've got it kicked off. I've got the first few thousand words down. I have the initial stage set, and now I have to engage the story. So I was still struggling until very recently, still struggling with the idea of how do I tell the story of an alien that's not the story of a man in a bug suit? And the answer is, I think, I don't. I think that's been my issue. Part of it is that I need to understand how body image, how sensory input affects cognition, because Quith have only one eye. It's a large eye, but it's only one eye, and so depth perception is a bit of a problem. They make up for it with other senses. Specifically, Quith leaders are able to pick up emotional responses from other beings, other sentients, according to the Siglopedia, anyway. And so I've been using that and adding to the eye color chart. There is, for example, no eye color associated with amusement or pleasure, which I found not terribly surprising given that the source material is from Sigler. But amusement and pleasure are both things that I think might be lacking, in part because the context in which we meet Quith are limited to confrontational. So how do we cope with that? I think we offer other contexts. One of the things that I've fallen back on is looking at the hero's journey as an archetype for story, and realizing that one of my problems with trying to tell the story of a young Quith leader is that I don't have the archetypes in place for that kind of story. Just like you wouldn't try to tell a science fiction story without some trope, some of the artifacts of science fiction, or a fantasy story without some kind of magic, some sort of fantastical element. I can't really tell a coming-of-age story, which is really what this story is about, without some of these archetypes that Campbell laid out so beautifully in Hero's Journey. I'm seeing it more like a guideline than a recipe, sort of like the way I follow recipes in cookbooks. Yeah, I like this ingredient, so I'm going to add a little more of it. I don't like that ingredient. I'm not going to add quite so much. Structurally, as long as I'm not baking, and I need to have the balance of ingredients correct in order for the cake to come out or for the bread to rise or whatever. Structurally, as long as what I'm cooking is not dependent on ratio, but is really only looking at seasoning, I think I can play with this. So one of the things I've added is not a sidekick, because a leader can't have a sidekick. Leader can have followers. But it's bothered me, how does a young leader become an adult leader? Do they, and I think I've mentioned the notion of noblesse oblige, the obligation of a leadership to care for those in whom trust, from whom trust has been gained. And to what degree does this idea, this really human idea, translate into the quiff? Is it strictly pheromones? Is it strictly hormonal? Is it strictly instinctual? Or is it partly a learned response? Is it something that I can use to differentiate Greedock from other leaders and give him an edge over other leaders by giving him this additional facet? And while he is ruthlessly, from one perspective, ruthlessly manipulative, from another perspective, logical, and then to a certain extent, caring, because while he cares deeply for his own, he views everyone who's not his as an enemy, and therefore not worthy of consideration. In a certain sense, a threat. You're either with me or against me sort of idea. And so there's no compunction about dealing with the enemy and everyone outside of his circle is an enemy, or at least potentially an enemy. Even allies may turn. Which I think is going to be one of the themes. So yeah, some good progress. I really like the way this book is coming together. I could wish it was coming together a little faster. 18 and a half minutes for the second mile. Not a great second mile, but not a bad one. At least I'm out and walking. And the notice that I have reached my second mile is also an indicator that I'm at the back gate. The time for me to say tomorrow is another day, and with any luck at all, I'll talk to you then.